Welcome to World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Talkley reporting, as usual, from Washington, D.C., and we have a lot to report about today, in particular, some big events on the anti-Obama front. In particular, the release now, either tomorrow or today or Sunday, of the Obama deception. This is, quite frankly, a masterpiece of political documentary filmmaking. Congratulations go to Alex Jones and his team there at InfoWars in Austin, Texas, for putting together a very complete and very incisive profile of the Obama deception. And as I've stressed for many weeks, that's the essence of Obama: deception, dissembling, duping, bait and switch, trickery, the old shell game, but the notion of using an ideological illusion to dupe people into becoming active collaborators in their own repression and suppression. That's the essence of Obama, and that's exactly where this documentary film is centered. So I urge everybody to go to InfoWars.com, PrisonPlanet.com, and order copies of this. Get yourself some physical copies and distribute them according to the guidelines that are indicated there, and make this into a real international event. And I would not be surprised if we didn't see this documentary at the Cannes Film Festival, at the Venice Film Festival, and at the Berlin Film Festival in the coming year, because this is now a turning point, I believe, in the mass awareness of Obama and the Obama machine. And, of course, it's about 110 to 120 minutes. I've only seen some clips, but clips that actually add up to just about all of it. But at the same time, it's much better to go and order your copy so that you can see it straight through from beginning to end. And there's interest in this around the world. I know one of the leading German anti-establishment blogs has already got an extensive coverage of it, and I'm sure many more will follow in the days to come. So we may be able to report some more about this before the program ends today. But the Obama deception. Then I also add my own book, Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide Through the Worst Financial Crisis in Human History. For this, you've got to go to one place, www.progressivepress.com. ProgressivePress.com, and there you find a click link to click on and order an electronic copy first, sent directly from Progressive Press, and a paper copy following as soon as the paper copy is ready, which won't be too long. And the way things are going, this is a good thing to invest in at the present time. If you'd been following the advice given in the book, you would be essentially held harmless, I would say, by the events that have happened. And actually, I can't be in the business of dispensing financial advice to individuals. This depends on one's own individual circumstances and so forth. But generally speaking, I believe very much that the advice given in the book is sound. The larger part, of course, is the policy advice, and this is absolutely sound: how to get out of a depression. And we will be looking at the references in the book to the Wilhelm Lautenbach plan of 1931. This is a guy called Lautenbach. He was a top official of the German finance ministry in the pre-Hitler period, and he had a method of mobilizing national credit through the banks in order to allow an ambitious program of public works and infrastructure building, which, if implemented, would have stopped Hitler and avoided the Second World War. And this is something we'll talk about in some detail later in the program. So this is one of the many, many important things you're going to find in Surviving the Cataclysm, the Lautenbach plan that was given at the meeting of the Friedrich List Society in 1931 with the president of the Reichsbank, Luther, and Schaeffer later on, who became important in the post-war period in terms of the D-Mark and the Kreditanstalt, the credit institution for reconstruction in Germany, and so forth. All of this covered and much, much more, the immiseration of America, the at that time, 10 years ago, one-half decline of the standard of living since the Lyndon B. Johnson period. Now it's more like two-thirds after the ravages of the Bush years. The deindustrialization of America by Paul Adolf Volcker and the Federal Reserve with the 22% prime rate brought in by Jimmy Carter and continued under Reagan. No economic difference between Carter and Reagan in that regard, just that under Reagan they were able to get a bubble going. And the bubble is now what's coming down. That's the Reagan bubble that's collapsing around your ears right now. At the same time, we've also got the chapter Derivatives Madness. That's the heart of the matter right now. This is a world derivatives crisis, as we will be explaining in much detail in today's program once again. You look at somebody like Harry Madoff. How did Harry Madoff do that for 20 years? How did he carry out this Ponzi scheme? With derivatives is the answer. Derivatives, derivatives, derivatives. Harry Madoff is one of the great derivatives engineers of all time. And without derivatives, it's almost impossible to see how he could have kept this going. Notice the studious avoidance of even the word derivatives by the corporate Wall Street-controlled news media. They don't want you to know that derivatives are at the heart of the matter. But, of course, the fact is that they are. Harry Madoff, derivatives thief extraordinaire, except, of course, Harry Madoff, what did he steal? $50 billion? Well, the estimates are now that the loss of paper values, and I stress paper values, this is not wealth. Don't kid yourself that this was ever wealth. It's not. It's just paper values. But in terms of paper values, the notion is that during 2008, about $50 trillion of paper values were wiped out. Who's responsible? Well, those people are responsible for that who deregulated derivatives. Derivatives were banned from 1936 under the New Deal and Franklin D. Roosevelt. Derivatives were banned until the coming of the poor, bungling Ronald Reagan, the man who sleptwalked through history. And one of the things he did when, in one of his rare moments of wakefulness there, when he was drooling and dozing in the Oval Office most of the time, was to put his name on a 1982 law which made derivatives supposedly legal. Except that really wasn't enough, and there was still the stigma of illegality on derivatives from 1982 on. Enter at this point Wendy Graham of the Commodity Futures Trading Corporation, who in the waning days of Bush the Elder in early 1993, in those first days of January when everybody was looking at Clinton, she managed to guarantee a safe haven for derivatives thanks to the CFTC. This is the same Wendy Graham who was served on the board of directors of Enron Corporation. She was actually on the audit committee of Enron Corporation, and she's been sued successfully for neglecting her fiduciary responsibilities to the Enron stockholders. She's had to cough up millions of dollars as part of that settlement. How about the trillions that she's lost the American people by providing a safe haven for the deadly virus and AIDS of derivatives in the U.S. financial system? We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today. We'll be right back.
bring your attention today to two big developments in the anti-Obama mobilization, and those are the release of the Obama deception by Alex Jones over at InfoWars. I believe the best political documentary to come out of the United States in many years, the Obama deception, and you can get that at InfoWars.com and PrisonPlanet.com. I would call it a masterpiece of political documentary, and it's got a depth and a base of documentation, which I believe is completely unmatched, and it uses simply the reality principle to cut through the illusions, delusions, and hysteria of the Obama bots as they proceed from mass manipulation and mass brainwashing during the campaign to the continued attempt to do that. It is a grave military threat. We've got Susan Rice at the United Nations flying below the radar. Susan Rice, who is trying very hard to start a war with Sudan. And the gold, of course, not the humanitarian goal that she prates about, but Susan Rice's goal is to cut off the 7 or 8% of the Chinese oil supply, which comes from those Sudanese oil wells. And that is the reason that they target the leader of Sudan, General Bashir, not because of human rights. And if they were concerned about human rights, they would not have been fomenting civil war with the Sudanese People Liberation Army under the late John Garang, who was trained at Fort Leavenworth, and also the basic pattern of U.S., British, Israeli interference into Sudan over decades is too well documented to be mistaken. So this is hypocrisy and a double standard, and it is likely to lead to war with the biggest country in Africa in geographical terms. Let's have a wonderful time with Obama, the peace angel. Let's have another continent in flames, not enough to have the Middle East in flames, Afghanistan in flames. Let's add Africa in flames, and that is where this policy is going, for which Obama is the eager front man. So that's one side. The other side, of course, is the Obama bailout policy. We just had in this excellent documentary, The Obama Deception, we've got Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, Pelosi saying that without Obama's phone calls and arm twisting and organizing to many members of Congress, and I would add especially the Black Caucus, where he did yeoman service, the entire first round of the TARP, the $700 billion bailout of the derivatives holdings, the toxic paper, meaning derivatives of the banks, this never would have passed. And we have Pelosi saying so. So the entire bailout process is something for which Obama is actively co-responsible. And that means by now $10 trillion and counting for the banks. And this is the essence of the fakery. It's nice to have $20 billion more for something like food stamps. It's nice to have $40 billion to pay some unemployment benefits. But these are the crumbs. The $40 billion for unemployment benefits, the $20 billion for food stamps are absolutely essential. They should be multiplied by 5 to 10 to get to a serious approach to this stuff. In the meantime, in the background, $10 trillion go to the white, the raptors, predators, jackals, and other parasites of Wall Street. So that's the second point. And then, of course, you've got the entire dictatorship agenda, the Organize for America, the Obama Rahm Emanuel National Service going on in the meantime. So all of this stuff is amply covered in the Obama deception, and I think it will be a turning point in the mass awareness of the Obama regime. That's one side. Then the other side, of course, surviving the cataclysm, your guide to the worst economic crisis, worst financial crisis in human history. And you can get that from Progressive Press of California, www.progressivepress.com. Click on the link that you find there and order a copy right away. So let's see what we've got going this week. Otherwise, we've got the need to look at these Obamavilles. I put out a release on Sunday evening, the Obamavilles, you know, in the crisis of the 1890s, and this is an important one to remember. This is where the Federal Reserve comes from. Federal Reserve did not start at Jekyll Island. The main arrangements that are the Federal Reserve system, meaning the control of the public debt of the United States by Morgan and London, did not start under Woodrow Wilson with Jekyll Island. No, it starts in 1895, and there's some reason a lot of people want to avoid this very interesting fact. 1895 is the great dollar crisis when the British, having their own crisis going on, they've got a Barings crisis going on and a South American loan crisis. The British, as they always did, after the fall of the Bank of the United States, after Andrew Jackson wiped out an independent credit system in this country, the United States became the total thrall and puppet of London and the London gold market. That's from about 1835-36 until the Civil War. The main event there, the crisis, the panic of 1837 that shut down economic development and put the U.S. on the skids towards a civil war, is a result of not having the Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, Henry Clay, Daniel Webster Bank of the United States. Everybody good in that period is in favor of a Bank of the United States. The dubious Andrew Jackson is against it, but that's why he is a failure as a president. But if we go on, we find that under Lincoln, we have the greenbacks. And that means that from about 1861-62 until 1877, with the resumption of gold payment, the U.S. is once again independent of the British gold market and British financial manipulation. So the British are the ones who do this stuff. And that is, I think, an important historical thing to hang on to. In the 1890s, we had the British going after the dollar, organizing a run on the gold backing of the United States dollar. And at the height of the crisis, there's a famous meeting of Grover Cleveland with J.P. Morgan. Grover Cleveland, president of the United States, an austerity Democrat, just like Obama, grovels for Morgan and the British. And the deal is that the British and Morgan will control the public debt of the United States, and they will call off their dogs. They will stop speculating against the gold backing. Boy, a real president would have had J.P. Morgan clapped in irons, thrown into jail, exchange controls, capital controls, all of that could have been done. Incidents with the British on the high seas. None of that from Grover Cleveland. He capitulated. That's the origin of the Federal Reserve. That was made into law about a decade later, two decades later. Back in a minute.
Are you tired of searching for Freak Talk Radio? Well, search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Webster Topley here in Washington, D.C. So we've got the Obamavilles. We've got the shanty towns, euphemistically known as tent cities, and they exist basically all over. You've got them in California. You've got them in Georgia. You've got them in Nevada. You've got them everywhere that there are large urban centers. This is the fruit of foreclosure. And this is what Obama's refusing to address. These have to be called Obamavilles. Now, the origin of the name, back in the 1890s, when Grover Cleveland capitulated to J.P. Morgan and London in the middle of a depression and the British organized run on the gold backing of the dollar, there were bread lines. This was actually a time when many people starved to death. And Grover Cleveland knew that people were starving to death, literally starving to death in the United States. And he said, oh, I can't interfere because of the laws of the free market. I guess Grover Cleveland was an Austrian before the fact. He embodied the spirit of Austrian economics. And, of course, this is the 1880s, 1890s is when this Austrian school emerged in a fight against the German school. The German school, much more effective, built Germany as a great industrial power. The Austrian school left you with a rotten empire that was about to fall apart in World War One. So there's no doubt that even though the Austrian school won the academic debate with the German school won the practical debate. So it means that their methods, of course, were protectionism, dirigism, mercantilism. That's what works. Economic nationalism is what works. Free trade, free markets, the demonization of government intervention and regulation does not work. And that's what people found here in the United States. So when they were on a breadline, what they called it was a Cleveland cafe. Now, of course, when we had the same free marketeers running the country during the 1920s, the reactionary Republicans, Harding, Coolidge, Hoover, and, of course, the common denominator above all of them, the common numerator above all of them, Andrew Mellon, the top monetarist of the time, Andrew Mellon, pro-fascist, Andrew Mellon, tax cheat, National Gallery of Art here in Washington, D.C. is a monument to his under-the-table deal with Roosevelt, which was far too lenient, in my opinion. This guy should have gone to jail. But Andrew Mellon, he contributed his fantastically valuable art collection with paintings by Raphael and other great Renaissance artists. That's now the nucleus of the National Gallery of Art. He did that because he had been caught cheating on his taxes, and he then was forced to settle, according to reliable reports, which have not been refuted by the most recent bought and paid for pseudo-academic biography of Andrew Mellon. He didn't believe that rich people should be forced to pay taxes, so I guess he could have been a member of the Obama administration. He'd fit right in with Geithner and the rest of these people. So Andrew Mellon, of course, was the guy who said, liquidate everything. He's the founder of the liquidationist school, which we still have with us. Liquidate stocks, liquidate bonds, liquidate real estate, liquidate labor. Too bad if you get liquidated and too bad if you die, because the process of creative destruction, later codified by Schumpeter, which Andrew Mellon talked about, of course, takes a while to go through, work itself out. And if you're on the losing end and the receiving end of that, then you're in very, very bad shape. And, of course, the idea was that once you do all this, there will be a recovery. But where's the guarantee that there's going to be a recovery? Some people tried this in the 1930s. It never worked. There's no place in the world that had a recovery before approximately 1939 to 1944, and people say, well, that was automatic with the war. A lot of places didn't have any recovery even during the war. Some places had no recovery to the degree that they went to concentration camp economics. That is the economic basis of the Nazi war economy. So anyway, back to the main line here. We're trying to talk about the Cleveland cafes, and, of course, under Andrew Mellon, in the 1930s, 1920s, into the 1930s, his policies kept going with Hoover, even though he had departed from the scene a little bit early. This, of course, was the breadline and the shanty town, now known as the Hooverville. So we've got the Cleveland Cafe. We've got the Hooverville, the Cleveland Cafe in the 1890s, the Hooverville in the 1930s. And now we've got tent cities. What should they be called? I suppose the left libs would want to call them Bushtown or something like this. The problem is that gets you nowhere. Bush is no longer your problem. There's a big effort going on with, Chris Matthews and Olbermann to keep people's rage focused on Bush. It's too late. It's gone. It's over with. Your problem is now Obama and Summers and Geithner. And indeed, these are the people that brought you derivatives. This is the Robert Rubin, Goldman Sachs, Citibank clique. And remember, derivatives were illegal from 1936 to 1982 as the result of a New Deal law. Somebody had tried to corner the wheat market using options. Options in agricultural commodities were outlawed, illegal, banned. 1936 to 1982. Along comes Reagan, stuffed to the gills with Milton Friedman, von Hayek, von Mises, and the rest of the Austrians, and he says, oh, this is unwarranted government interference into the wonderful magic of the marketplace. Yeah, the magic of the marketplace. So still the stigma of illegality stuck to the derivatives from 1982 until 1993. Then comes Wendy Graham, the future failure in her function at the Enron Board of Directors, where she led the audit committee and was later on the losing end of various lawsuits, had to disgorge money, pay back money or pay damages. So Wendy Graham. And then there's a battle under Clinton. And the interesting thing is the people who are running economic policy today were on the wrong side of the derivatives controversy under Clinton. On the right side was Brooks Lieborn. Brooks Lieborn, a courageous federal regulator woman, who wanted to at least make derivatives reportable. Let's find out how many there are. What could be wrong with that? Oh, no, said Greenspan. That will chill the wonderful magic of the marketplace. So Greenspan of the Federal Reserve came down against her. Oh, no, said Bob Rubin, the guy who's now driven Citibank into the ground so that they're lucky if their stock is worth, what, $1.75. And that's a big improvement. It's up almost 100% in the last couple of weeks, couple of days, this week. Rubin said, no, you can't interfere with the wonderful innovation of the marketplace and the creation of these wonderful new instruments that make everything so much better. And, of course, Brooks Lieborn was defeated. The forces of Rubin and Greenspan carried the day with the help of Rubin's protege, Larry Summers. And Larry Summers, this character, the president of Harvard who talks like a gangster, he sounds like a hoodlum from Brooklyn, but he's the czar in the White House of economics. Poor little tiny Tim Geithner is a protege of Summers. So look, Summers is a protege of Rubin. Geithner is a protege of Summers. And this is the situation. So Geithner, little tiny Tim, the reason that he is so bollocksed up in public is because Summers can't decide what to do about the derivatives. And, of course, there's nothing you can do because you're dealing with a couple of trillion at most that you might be able to extort from the Congress, although even that is getting harder and harder. And on the other hand, you've got 1,500 trillion of derivatives. So in the best of all possible worlds, you've got 1/500th of the bubble to work with, and you're going to try to shore up the bubble. So that's the story with the Obamavilles. We'll say a few things more about the Obamavilles in a minute. Number of cities and states. CBS Evening News covered it late last week. NBC Nightly News covered it this Monday. We're recording once again on the afternoon of Friday the 13th. Can it be? Yes, it's Friday, March 13th, and we're only 2 days from the Ides of March. The Ides of March, politically, coming up. So, we're in the middle now of the process of, we're told from the InfoWars studio that they're in the middle of the process of getting ready to ship the copies of the DVD. It has been partially released online. Anyway, to keep up with that, go to InfoWars.com, PrisonPlanet.com. Again, it's a masterpiece. It is the best political documentary to come out of the United States in many years. And if Michael Moore could win something at Cannes with Fahrenheit 9/11, then certainly this one ought to be a candidate, and we'll see if those decadent European intellectuals, Eurogarks and Eurocrats at Cannes and Venice and Berlin will entertain such a possibility. I hope they will. It would give them a great deal of moral standing, which they need. The problem with the Obamavilles is, of course, that this comes from foreclosures. And we've been calling on this program since the summer of 2007. The solution to foreclosures is to stop foreclosures. If you want to put a floor under the American people and prevent them from falling into the abyss, one of the key boards, planks of that floor is a federal law that says all foreclosures are banned. Foreclosures are illegal. You foreclose, you get a new roof over your head, and it's called Leavenworth. That will effectively chill the foreclosure activity in a way that nothing else can. Oh, yes, but what about the sanctity of contracts and what the sanctity of human life, the sanctity of the family, the sanctity of the lives of the children who are the main victims of this? That trumps the sanctity of the foreclosure contract. So don't talk about foreclosures. Foreclosures are the path to national suicide. Stop foreclosures of primary residences. Obviously, if you own 50 houses and you're flipping them, then a lot of those, all of them but one, can be foreclosed on. Everybody deserves to have one home, one and only one. No house at the seashore, no house in the mountains. But your primary residence must be protected, and that protection must be total, airtight, ironclad. At the same time, family farms, as we heard from that disturbing report from Wisconsin, the dairy farmers, who are some of the best in the world, are getting less than 40% of parity for their products. Now, that parity ought to be jacked up to 100 or 110 or 120% to allow the family farm to survive. But in the meantime, what we can do for sure is to ban foreclosures on family farms. And this then has to be extended to any business in productive activity. We can't protect banks. We can't protect stockbrokers. We can't protect flippers of real estate. But we've got to protect businesses, the dry cleaner, the auto repair shop, the restaurant, the deli, anything that provides a real productive activity or a real service, a ferry, a shipping line, a trucking company, a taxi company, an airline, a railroad, anything like that, has got to be protected. No shutdowns. Now, we've just had Circuit City go out of existence in the past 7 days. It's about 570 stores, 35,000 jobs. Wait a minute. We just gave $700 billion to Citibank, to J.P. Morgan Chase, to Bank of America. Now, they obviously didn't lend anything to Chrysler, GM, and Ford when they needed it. The government had to come in again. How about Circuit City? Did these bankers say, well, after so much largesse from the public, we're going to move in and save 35,000 jobs? No. They let Circuit City go under. And now you're getting this cumulative buildup, right? You're losing 600,000 to 700,000 jobs per month. And Circuit City, obviously, a big part of 1 month with 35,000 jobs. This is an absolute disaster. Stop foreclosures. Stop dithering. Stop foreclosures. Interesting cartoon in the Washington Post this week, Obama's wishing well. The wishing well is the banks. Again, I've called it a black hole, but let's have a little bit milder metaphor. Obama's wishing well is the money center banks, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank. Those are zombie banks, of course, but let's stay away from zombies and Dracula for a minute and black holes and the scary stuff. It's Obama's wishing well. And what Obama does is he comes up to the banking wishing well and he dumps in $700 billion and he says, if that's not enough, I have another $2 trillion for you, according to Geithner's abortive press conference of February 10th. $2 trillion more. And we make a wish. You dump in your $700 billion and you say, please restart lending. Please restart lending. Yeah, wait a minute. Circuit City needed commercial loans to reorganize in bankruptcy. They didn't get them. 35,000 jobs have now been destroyed. Anything from Obama about that? Not a peep. Obama tried this past week to become a stock tout. He tried to recommend that it's time to start buying stock. Obama is so economically ignorant, he doesn't know what a price-earnings ratio is. He thinks it's a profit-earnings ratio. That's what he said when he was sitting there with Gordon Brown at the White House. That given the profit-earning ratio, said the pompous, arrogant, elitist, and ignoramus and liar Obama, because of the profit-earning ratio, it now looks like stocks are getting to be a good deal. Well, if you go out and buy stocks, maybe you can sue him, right? Remember that Spitzer did a whole thing about the research that was offered by brokerage houses was completely skewed and completely fraudulent. Obama, now as the national stock picker and pump and dump operative, there's even speculation on the radio that Obama is selling stocks short, that Obama knows that whenever he gives a speech, the stock market will crash, and he's selling stocks short in advance. And then when they go down, he cashes in. I don't know about that one. That's coming from the reactionary side. But it could be. So all of this is going on. The big thing about the Obama bills is that they are the product of mass foreclosures and mass unemployment, which Obama has done nothing really still to stop foreclosures. That program of Obama's supposedly to deal with foreclosures is a series of voluntary incentives to the Angelo Mozillos and Countrywides of this world to try to get them to somehow mitigate or to make their looting practices a little bit milder vis-a-vis various people, and it doesn't seem to have any effect. So foreclosures roll on, the unemployment rolls on, 600,000 to 700,000 jobs per month lost. Now you get into the question of, the 1340s. In other words, the bubonic plague. When you have people living under distressed conditions in tent cities, guess what occurs? Go back to the Civil War, a time when a lot of people were living in tents. What you get is typhus, typhoid, and paratyphoid. Typhus in particular, camp fever, typhoid, paratyphoid. These are real diseases. These you don't want to get. And if things get really bad, maybe plague, bubonic plague, comes out of those Hoovervilles, those Obamavilles of today. So the Obamavilles are a threat to everybody. Naturally, the Austrian view would be, well, what do I care about those people? They guessed wrong. They bought too much house. They had the misfortune of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Ha ha. Those poor people, they overdid it. They were greedy. Why did they live in New Orleans? And so on and so on, would say the Austrian. The problem with the Austrian is this is the voice of the Ancien Régime. This is the voice, if you will, of Marie Antoinette, right? Well, you know, who cares? Why should we care about what's going on in those slums? Well, the problem is what goes on in those slums has something to do with the common line of defense of humanity against plague, against epidemic and pandemic diseases. So it's time to stop foreclosures, stop layoffs, and get rid of those Obamavilles. Back in a minute.
This is the GCN Radio Network.
As we're recording, it's the afternoon of Friday the 13th, and there's an apparition of Obama in the Oval Office saying that the administration is doing everything, working every day to get credit flowing again. And again, the main approach to that is Obama's wishing well. The wishing well of J.P. Morgan Chase, of Bank of America, Citibank, the Wells Fargo Wachovia Complex, Bank of New York Mellon, the derivatives monsters, in other words, the top five who have 95% of the derivatives. They are a black hole. They are Count Dracula. They are zombie banks, but they're also a wishing well into which Obama has already pitched $700 billion, and he wants to pitch $2 trillion more, according to Geithner. We just don't know exactly how. And the idea is you put in $2.7 trillion, and you make a wish. You hope that J.P. Morgan Chase will do what they haven't done in many decades, which is to lend for productive investments in plant and equipment. And I would just say to Obama, You're the president. You have a bank. It's called the Federal Reserve. Grab control of the Federal Reserve, wrench it out of the hands of that unelected cabal of anonymous, unaccountable, unelected private bankers, that clique of Wall Street parasites that own you, but you can still assert yourself, right? You have the powers of the presidency. You want to make loans? Make loans. You can do it with executive orders. You don't even need the Congress. Use the Defense Production Act. Use the Trading with the Enemy Act. Say, I'm seizing the Federal Reserve, and I'm directing them to issue $1 trillion of 0% recovery loans to productive activity only. And that's going to become infrastructure, and that's going to become our three science drivers, space exploration, colonization, and industrial production. That's going to become biomedical research to find cures for diseases and save money on health care through cures, the only humane and human way to do it. The only way that doesn't land you in a Nuremberg dock, because any other way lands you in that dock, as Senator Daschle should take note, and now Secretary Sibelius should also take note. And the third one, of course, high energy physics, so that you have thermonuclear fusion power and beyond. So Obama is praying for, you know, he's doing rain dances to get J.P. Morgan Chase to issue credit. Well, you know, if General Motors, Ford, Chrysler at the end of December, beginning of January wasn't enough, we've just had Circuit City go down, 35,000 jobs lost, and nobody at Chase Manhattan seem to be running to give loans to save those jobs. So this policy is a failure. Obama's wishing well is a failure. The transfusion to the economy through Count Dracula, who's sucking the blood, is a failure. The attempt to keep the zombie banks marching along is a failure. Seize the Federal Reserve, issue $1 trillion 0% federal credit for production and for production only, not for narcotics, not for drug money laundering, not for financial services in any form. Now, the theoretical basis, let's go back to an interesting distant mirror for us. We had this guy, Wilhelm Lautenbach, Lautenbach. He was an official of the German finance ministry in the late 1920s, early 1930s, and in particular, we're looking at 1931, a secret meeting of the Friedrich List Society. And the Friedrich List Society is something you don't seem to have in the United States today. Good economists. In other words, economists who are not Austrian, they're not Chicagoan, they're not Keynesian, they're not Malthusian, but they're actually human, and they want to avoid the collapse of the German economy, and they also like to avoid the dictatorship of Schacht and Hitler, because those two went together. Hjalmar Schacht, S-C-H-A-C-H-T, and Hitler and the Nazis are one combine. So here we are in Berlin. It's September 16th, 17th, 1931, and they're meeting in the building of the German Central Bank, the Reichsbank, and what do you do? Well, here is the series of alternatives that that Lautenbach lays out. Now, let me just give you the source of this so you'll see where it comes from. The speech is called Möglichkeiten einer Konjunkturbelebung durch Investitionen und Kreditausweitung. That is to say, possibilities of improving business conditions through investments and credit expansion. And this is published in a book by Knut Borchardt and Hans Otto Schütz. And this is called Wirtschaftspolitik in der Krise, die Geheimkonferenz der Friedrich List Gesellschaft vom September 1931 über Möglichkeiten und Folgen einer Kreditausweitung. So, economic policy in the crisis, secret meeting of the Friedrich List Society, September 1931, about the possibilities and consequences of credit expansion, published in Baden-Baden, Germany by Nomos, 1991. And then there we have a discussion of this meeting. So what does Lautenbach say? He says, look, there are different kinds of economic emergencies, right? Some of them are natural catastrophes, but some of them then are economic panics. So what do you do? He goes through the possibilities, and this, I think, is absolutely critical for us today. He says, let's see how some people say we should fight a depression. One would be budget cuts, tax reductions, and reductions in public spending. Now, this, of course, this is exactly what the reactionary Republicans demand today. This is the line coming from Limbaugh and Boehner, or Boehner, whatever his name is. And Mitch McConnell, you don't really hear from Mitch McConnell, but the Republican ideologues say budget cuts, tax reductions, cut public expenditure, balance the budget. Lautenbach immediately has the intelligence to say this is totally counterproductive. It's insufficient and counterproductive because we're in a depression. That's the thing these guys don't want to understand. Thanks to Bush, thanks, of course, to Greenspan, to Bernanke, thanks to Rubin, thanks to Summers, thanks to Clinton for signing this stuff. We are in a depression. So what's the problem in the depression? As Lautenbach says, there's a surplus of unused productive capacity and unemployed labor. What you've got to do is take empty factories and unemployed workers and put them together. You've got to get production going. That is the goal of your policy. Not to cut the budget. Naturally, in a budget as large as the U.S. one, the more you cut the federal budget, the more you're depressing economic activity, the more you're decreasing tax receipts, the more you cut the budget, the bigger the deficit will be. That's the secret of the modern U.S. budget. Lautenbach is not quite at that point. So just budget austerity, fiscal austerity of the kind preached by the O'Reillys, Hannitys, and Boehners, this is absolutely insufficient. So the other problem they had in Germany is actually even worse than the U.S. They would say, we don't have any long-term capital. We can't borrow on the foreign market. We can't borrow on the domestic market. How could we finance doing anything? How can we create a new national demand? Well, the U.S. is not quite at that point. We may soon be there. So Lautenbach says the main problem is unused productive capacity and unemployed labor, and therefore we have got to go in there and produce demand. In other words, not do rain dances and hope that confidence will revive, but create demand. Create demand for borrowing, lending, and create demand for purchases, in particular of high technology capital goods. Back in a minute with more from Lautenbach, 1931.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Economic recovery elaborated by Wilhelm Lautenbach at that landmark meeting of the Friedrich List Society in Berlin in 1931. He reviewed, as we've just summarized, the alternatives offered by monetarism. And that meant essentially deflation, right? What the liquidationists, what Andrew Mellon was preaching then, what the Austrians are preaching today. Deflation, meaning budget cuts, falling wages, falling prices, factory closures, increasing unemployment, and of course tax cuts would go along with that. You can put tax cuts in there. That works fine in that framework. So Lautenbach says this is counterproductive and untenable. Now, what's the alternative? The only alternative seemed to be an attempt to stimulate the economy by way of low interest rates and easy money and various kinds of government spending. But the problem is that if this is done, you generate a lot of hot money. And the hot money will tend to flee the country, in that case Germany, flee the country and collapse the exchange rate even further. Now, isn't that interesting? Look what we had with the $700 billion of the TARP. The Kucinich Committee in Congress is now coming up with reports on how J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, and Bank of America, instead of investing the TARP money in General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, or Circuit City, or anything else that might be productive and might be here in the United States, they lent the money to Dubai, they lent the money to India. We know that the AIG money went to European banks of all sorts that were the counterparties of the AIG credit default swap derivatives. So Lautenbach is quite prophetic. If you try to simply reflate, if you just spew out 0% credit, low interest rates and easy money, hot money will be created. The hot money will flee the country for better speculative possibilities elsewhere. You'll collapse the exchange rate. You go into debt. And it's probably a path to hyperinflation. Now, Lautenbach then switches from the monetarist approach to the physical economic approach, which is the one that he wants to argue. We have merchandise in the form of unsold inventories. Hey, look at all those cars sitting on docks. Look at all those unsold inventories. You've got unemployed workers. You've got idle factories. We still have a few factories left. We have all kinds of factories and productive equipment that might be mobilized, and we can build more. We can revive machine tools and build even more of them. Recovery, says Lautenbach, is a matter of reorganizing these resources. And then the answer is, well, wait a minute, we've got this huge deficit. So Lautenbach, taking a direct lead from Friedrich List, who's, of course, Friedrich List is one of your American system economists. He became an American citizen and lived in Reading, Pennsylvania. So Lautenbach says, the task is easy to solve in principle. The state needs to produce a new national demand. And that means, first of all, infrastructure. Infrastructure is a national investment for your economy. It's something of permanent value. Market fluctuations cannot take away a new maglev rail line from New York to San Francisco. It's a permanent addition, durable, valuable. It'll last 100 years if you build it right, and you might as well build it right. Publicly supported public works are an increase in value for the economy, and you've got to do them anyway, especially here in the United States where we haven't been doing them, and we've probably got a $5 trillion plus deficit of infrastructure. Now, where do you get the cash? This is the least of it. The states are bankrupt. The federal government is running a huge deficit. Right now, as Lautenbach says, reasonable public works are neglected in times of deep economic depression. But we can do something about that. Liquidity is simply a technical organizational issue. Commercial banks, and we're thinking in the United States today of local and regional commercial banks, are liquid. They have liquidity when they are sufficiently supported by the national bank. Yeah. So what you've got to do, this is what I've been arguing here for months, is that you've got to reflate the regional and local banking system with 0% credit for production issued from the nationalized Federal Reserve. And what Lautenbach talks about is technically how I've said this should be done also. This is called your discount guarantee or rediscount guarantee. In other words, if a state, let's say California, decides that they're going to start building the transcontinental maglev railway from San Francisco over to the Nevada border, they can issue bonds to do that. The bonds will be bought by the local banks, and there'll be an automatic rediscount of those by the nationalized Federal Reserve, by the Fourth Bank of the United States. In other words, you buy a California maglev bond, you're a local bank, Sacramento, whatever it is, you take that to the Federal Reserve and you say, I want cash for this, and it's automatic. You put in the bond, money comes out. And that's the way you get a recovery. Now imagine you're building a coast-to-coast transcontinental maglev railway system. Let's say 25,000 miles of maglev railway to start with, three transcontinentals, two coastals, one gulf, and so forth, and then all of the connections in various parts of the United States. 25,000 miles of maglev leading towards 50,000 miles of maglev in the following year. 100 nuclear reactors, high-temperature pebble bed, fourth-generation nuclear reactors of the most modern type, the most energy-intensive, capital-intensive, the most productive, the most valuable, the best technology you can get without hysterical Malthusian ideology influencing your choice, without letting the Sierra Club and the Friends of the Earth and the Canoe Federation dictate your choices. So you can then go on. Right? You can go on to rebuilding the water systems of all American cities. You also have got to create attractive, modern, safe, pleasant, efficient mass transit, urban mass transit to get cars off the road. This is an area where even the global warming devotees should join in. So what Lautenbach has basically said here, it's the rediscount guarantee that is the necessity. And the way you can do that is essentially to nationalize your central bank. You don't allow it to be controlled by these degenerate bankers, these parasites that we've been railing against, and you force them to rediscount or give cash, is what this means, bonds and indeed commercial paper generated by productive activity. That's Lautenbach, 1931. Of course, if that had been done, Hitler would have been stopped in his tracks. No Nazi regime, probably no World War II. Was it worth it? Was it a good idea? I think so. I think so. I think Lautenbach was right, and the monetarists were wrong. Back in a minute. Okay, summing up the report of Wilhelm Lautenbach to the Frederick List Society, Berlin, September 1931. This is right after the British, by the way, had gone off the gold standard, right? This is the British default of September 1931, which is what made the Great Depression what it was, even though Calamity Schles and other operatives of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Roosevelt haters over there in the CFR, don't want to understand this. One of the reasons it was hard to get out of the Depression in the 1930s was that the British had deliberately wrecked the world monetary system, the entire system for financing world trade. All import-export stuff in those days generally went through London in the form of a pound sterling bill of exchange drawn on a bank in London. And when the British defaulted on gold payment in September of 1931, this froze and wrecked the entire system of payment for import-export deals worldwide. And that's what the Germans were dealing with. And the time that Lautenbach is speaking is just the same time that that British gold default of September 1931 is leading to the collapse of the Kreditanstalt in Vienna. And then it's going to come over to the Danat Bank in Germany, and then it's going to go into Holland, and then into London, and then it's going to go into the United States. And the U.S. is going to have a banking panic from 1932 into 1933. So this is when Lautenbach is speaking. So again, his argument is Germany had masses of merchandise in the form of unsold inventories, millions of unemployed who could be productively unemployed, hundreds of idle factories. Recovery is a matter of reorganizing these resources, not of rugged individualism, not of all of these idiotic slogans that work well in McGuffey's reader, but don't work well as the policy of a modern state in the derivatives depression, something that we've never had to deal with. But with government coffers empty, how could government action bring recovery about? Well, he says, the Reichsbank, the central bank, can generate as much liquidity as was needed. They order them to do it. Bond issues can be floated for infrastructure in transportation and related fields, water projects, road building, whatever, if commercial banks have the cash to purchase the bonds. What you need is a central bank policy, or indeed I would say a national banking policy, of guaranteeing that banks could always discount infrastructure bonds with the central bank. In other words, you give the nationalized Fed, the Bank of the United States, a California or New York or Illinois or Florida or Texas or North Dakota infrastructure bond, and they've got to give you cash. And that is the so-called discount guarantee, the redisconto guarantee, says Lautenbach, on infrastructure bonds. The projects that are financed increase employment. They help expand credit. There's a multiplier effect in there that's a real one. They increase the real capital stock of the whole economy. What is capital? Capital is infrastructure. It's a machine tool. It's an assembly line. It's something you can use. It's not a piece of paper. Capital would be a coast-to-coast maglev railway, and if you extend that to 25 or 50,000 miles of modern maglev in the United States, then you'd have a capital good of great value and permanent value, and there's no way that hot money fleeing to London or Tokyo or Kiev is going to wipe that out. So the projects financed increase employment, expand credit, increase the real capital stock of the economy. They provide a goal for national production as a whole. And, says Lautenbach, putting on his profits hat, if you don't do this, you will have a total collapse and utter ruin of the German economy. He even points out that things like the sort of potpourri, right, the grab bag that we have in the Obama stimulus, even the sort of halfway projects, right, the things that are okay but not essential, mean that you're using resources poorly. You're not putting the resources where you get the most bang for the buck. The most bang for the buck is infrastructure building of all types, provided it's modern, not gangrene economy, not windmills, not green jobs, not solar cells, none of this stuff, but the most modern energy production you can get. So you've got to use this. You got to use these resources. Okay, so Lautenbach says no effort of the present generation brings such a decisive and favorable advantage to future generations as the improvement of transportation, since these investments increase the productive powers of future generations extraordinarily and in a steadily rising progression. In other words, when you build infrastructure of that modern type, not the gangrene variety, but the modern type, you are increasing the productive powers of labor. Think how many man hours, person hours are lost by people sitting in traffic jams. The last time I looked in Surviving the Cataclysm, it's about 80 hours a year. 2 weeks, two working weeks of the entire U.S. population is spent sitting in useless traffic jams, not even your commute, but when you're not rolling, you're just sitting. There is a productive multiplier effect. We've seen this, too, in the United States in various things. And this is the dirigistic, productive, economic approach. By having investments and credit policy, says Lautenbach, the disproportion of supply and demand in the domestic market will be alleviated and total production provided with a direction and a goal. If we neglect to undertake such a policy, we will inevitably head in the direction of continuing economic disintegration and complete disruption of our national economy into a condition in which then, in order to avoid domestic political catastrophe, we will be compelled to undertake a strong increase in short-term public debt for purely consumptive purposes. This would be the dubious parts of the stimulus. Short-term public debt for purely consumptive purposes. And he says, don't do that. Today, while you still have the instruments, utilize credit for production. to bring the economy and the public finances into balance once more. Now, Lautenbach was opposed by Hjalmar Schacht, the vampire of the Reichsbank. He was actually the Morgan appointee. He was an agent of the House of Morgan in London and in New York, and he was the austerity enforcer. And he basically said, well, let's not have a broad-based program of infrastructure building, which would revive the economy. He said, let's have it based on a new speculative bubble in the stocks of the German arms industry. So let's have rearmament, and let's finance them with these paper instruments called MEFO bills, M-E-F-O. And that is, of course, the model for Obama's National Infrastructure Rediscount Bank. In other words, what they want to do is make it possible for Felix Rohatyn to privatize the New York Thruway or the New Jersey Turnpike or the Pennsylvania Turnpike or whatever it is, whichever ones haven't been privatized already, jack up the tolls and run them into the ground. That's what they mean when they say infrastructure investment. So that would be a perversion. That would be a mockery of what Lautenbach is calling for. It's got to be the production, the building of new things, not transferring ownership and increasing the tolls, not the idea that privatization is automatically going to solve anything, the way the governor of Indiana, the fool, has privatized the Indiana toll road or the Indiana Turnpike, whatever it is. This is not it. You've got to build new things, build new infrastructure. And that, I guess, the Lautenbach example, of course, this was it was tried very briefly. The government of General von Schleicher from late 1932 into January 1933 tried to do this. The British and Schacht and Morgan mobilized to knock him out of the box, and then you got Hitler. So there it is in a nutshell. Back in a minute. Washington reporting, calling your attention once again to the two big things that are going on the anti-Obama front. There are actually more, but these are two prominent ones. One is the release of the Obama deception by Alex Jones, Infowars.com. I have the honor of playing a certain role in this and glad to serve as usual. So that's available from Infowars.com. The Obama Deception, a masterpiece of documentary filmmaking, the best political documentary to come out of the United States in many, many a year. I urge you to support the initiative by buying copies. Make a bulk order. Do that right now. Fight back, and among other things, against FBI and related harassment of Alex and his friends. And the other one, my own book, second edition of Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide Through the Worst Economic Crisis in Human History. A couple of other notes. The Obama administration remains committed to union busting. And we've called our attention in the past to the fact that they're successfully busting the UAW. They're trying to actually bust the Canadian auto workers through the actions of the Raptor hedge fund, Cerberus hedge fund, which runs Chrysler. So they're trying to bust the auto workers, which are traditionally the most militant of all the unions, going back to the Walter Reuther period, the Toledo, Autolite, and Detroit sit-down strikes of the 1930s. They would like to bust that union. Barkey's family business is busting unions. He's a foundation operative. He's a foundation poverty pimp from the Gamaliel, the Joyce, the Woods, the Annenberg foundations. His mother was from the Ford. His mother actually worked for Geithner's father, as we found out, right? That Stanley Ann Dunham, mother of Obama, in her work at the Ford Foundation back in the previous decades, was working for Geithner's father. How interesting. So Obama wants to bust the teachers union too, not just the auto workers. And the way that they're doing this is they're making Washington, D.C. into the pilot project and the model for what they're doing. And this week, Obama once again went to a charter school. They've been doing this, it's gone once or twice before. And Obama says, for decades, Washington has been trapped in the same stale debates that have paralyzed progress and perpetuated our educational decline. And he says, if a teacher is given a chance but still does not improve, there is no excuse for that person to continue teaching. And now here's the big one. Obama says, quote, I reject a system that rewards failure and protects a person from its consequences, end quote. Hey, of course, only bankers get that from Barkey. Only Pandit the Bandit at Citibank, Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan Chase, and Ken Lewis of Bank of America get a system that rewards failure. And, of course, Merrill and AIG and indeed Bear and Lehman, they get a system that rewards failure and protects a person from its consequences. So if you're a banker, that's exactly what you get from Obama. But, of course, if you're a teacher, then they want to drive you out. The idea here is to demonize teachers. The bad teacher is the heart of the problem, says Michelle Rhee. Michelle Rhee is the chancellor of the D.C. school system. They're now going into contract talks. You can hear in Washington, you can hear the union is trying to defend itself with radio ads. Michelle Rhee is a foundation-funded union buster from the word go. The whole business about caring about students is a fraud. It's absolute hypocrisy. It's a camouflage and a smokescreen, typical of the General Obama deception. And rewarding failure and protecting people from the consequences of their own failure. Sounds like the TARP. Sounds like the various bailouts. Obama is willing to put $2.7 trillion of federal money behind a system that rewards failure and protects the bankers from its consequences, but of course not for teachers. Now, the teachers are fighting back. In the Washington Post of today, we have a story about how teachers, one of the problems they have is that they get beat up even in these wonderful charter schools, and the administration, Michelle Rhee, is trying to suppress the aggression, the violence of disruptive students towards teachers. If you try to report that, you're going to be in danger of getting fired or put on a short list of people who are going to be liquidated. So I hope the American Federation of Teachers under Ronnie Weingarten have some brains and realize that Obama's family business is to bust your union. His mother was from the Ford Foundation. He's from the Annenberg Foundation. The Annenberg Chicago Challenge was an attempted exercise in union busting of the Chicago Teachers Union. So they've got Arne Duncan, top union buster from Chicago, in there as the Secretary of Education, and it's time to get to work. Now, we hope to have time today for Calamity Schles, but Calamity Schles, the Roosevelt hater from the Council on Foreign Relations, and I know this is a problem for some of our Austrians out there, right? They say that Roosevelt was the darling of Wall Street. Roosevelt was supported by Wall Street. We have a book by Marquis Child called They Hate Roosevelt, and it's about the U.S. ruling class, Rockefeller, Mellon, Morgan. They hated Franklin D. Roosevelt. The hate lives on in the Council on Foreign Relations, which is not a humanitarian organization last time I looked. And we find today that Calamity Schles and her book, The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Depression, is continuing the anti-Roosevelt slander campaign. We don't have a lot of time for this, but we'll get back to it next week. Part of the Lautenbach discussion we had before is that Lautenbach was an admirer of the main thrust of the New Deal. And actually, in the New Deal, there were some features which were not good, which were failures. Be the first one to admit it. In particular, the idea of trying to reduce production to drive up prices. This is a very bad idea, and trying to create limitations on production in any form in order to drive up prices. Very bad idea. We don't seem to have too much of that today, primarily because there's so little production. Let's look for a minute, though, at Obama in all this. We're told by the Obama staff, Obama was too tired to do a proper welcome for Gordon Brown. There were the two theories on this. One is that Obama is faking it. In other words, he doesn't want you to see that he is dancing to Gordon Brown's tune. Gordon Brown is the guy who came out with the idea of bailing out banks. This started with Northern Rock, right? Hundreds of billions of pounds, tremendous amounts of British taxpayer money, 3,500 pounds per person in the British Isles going into the pockets of Lloyds Bank, Royal Bank of Scotland, and Northern Rock. So maybe Obama is trying to put some public distance between himself and Gordon Brown, since he's copying Gordon Brown's policies in every other way. But this idea that Obama is too tired. Remember the profile that we get of Obama in Obama, the unauthorized biography, which I commend to your attention, along with Obama, the Postmodern Coup. You can get those from Amazon.com. The idea that the Luo people, from which group Obama's father, Barack Hussein Obama Sr., is derived, they have a profile, and the British did the profiling. And the profiling is that the Luo are clever, superficial, lazy exhibitionists and showboaters. Clever, superficial, lazy exhibitionists and showboaters. So Obama's supposedly too tired. Obama also has this problem of a nervous tic under his right eye. He imitates Marshal Pétain of France in the idea of the tic around the eye. And he's supposedly having a lot of trouble staying away from cigarettes. In other words, Obama's a nicotine addict, and he's getting testy. The New York Times asked him if he was a socialist. He got all huffy. Normally you would laugh that one off. But no, Obama got huffy. So we'll be back next week. In the meantime, remember, the Obama deception from Infowars.com and surviving the cataclysm from ProgressivePress.com. See you next week.